September 29, 2018, in Bahrain, meeting with youth. The main things that I see with marriage is, please don't think that any situation, career, marriage, this or that, in this world, is really going to be the source of happiness or unhappiness. Don't peg your hopes on things in this world. As far as, you know, if I do this or that thing, if I marry this person, if I get married, if I have children, I don't have children, I live here, I live there. Can you all understand my English if I speak at regular speed? If I'm going too fast for any of you, would you tell me? I've been speaking at my normal pace. Don't think that that's going to be the source of your happiness. It just isn't. There's nothing in this world that is really going to create happiness for us. It's all going to be very mixed. There'll be some happiness and some distress. It'll be a mixed thing. Our real happiness is in our internal consciousness, our internal awareness, our connection with Krishna. Not in the situation. You know, a beautiful house and a compatible spouse will not make you happy if you're unhappy inside. It just doesn't work. And if you're happy inside, even if your life is a mess externally, you can still be happy. So please take that as something very important. If you're thinking, I'm going to get married and by marriage I'll become happy, this, you know, I'll find the right person that will make me happy. Probably not. You know, even if that's true to some extent, it's not going to be wholly true. You know, even if you're one of those lucky people that really find someone that, oh my God, I really love to be with this person, they're my best friend, and 40 years into the marriage, you're like, wow, this is still my best friend, and I'm so glad I'm sharing my life with this person. It's still not going to be what makes you internally happy in life. So, without spirituality, life is ultimately pretty empty. So that would be the first thing. You know, don't peg your hopes on something. I think when we're young, we think, you know, I'm going to figure out a way to manage the world so that I'll be able to be the controller and I'll be the enjoyer. Sorry. This world's not ours to control and enjoy like that. It just doesn't work. So aim for real spiritual happiness. And if you're really spiritually happy, then it's much easier to learn how to function in the world. If you're saying, well, if these things aren't going to make me happy, why do them anyway? Well, I see it as very practical. You know, we need to eat, we need a companion. Most of us have subtle and gross sexual needs. We want some independence, we want some money, we want to make a difference in the world. It's just real. We do want those things, and if we don't have some way of doing them nicely, then we just become disturbed. But they're not the source of our happiness, if that makes any sense at all. It's something like, you know, so this apartment, it's not too hot and it's not too cold. It's just basically comfortable. That doesn't make us happy. In fact, if it's just comfortable, we don't even think about it. It just goes out of our awareness. So a bad temperature can make us unhappy. If it's too cold or too hot, we can become unhappy. But a good temperature doesn't make us happy. So in a similar way, all the things in our life, if they're together, they kind of move out of our awareness and it becomes the foundation by which we can work on real happiness. And then, so that would be one really big thing, because I think a lot of reasons that people become unhappy in a marriage or in a career is if they put expectations on it that can't be met. You know, if you're thinking, this particular husband, this particular wife, this particular child, this particular house, this particular thing is going to satisfy me, and I'm now going to be happy, then you end up with a lot of disappointment, and you're not actually able to get the pleasure from the thing that's there. The other main thing that I see, all the main things that I really see that are important, something I talk about all the time, is to identify yourself spiritually. don't identify yourself as I am somebody's husband, or I am somebody's wife, I am somebody's father, I am somebody's mother, I am somebody's daughter, I am somebody's son. Get rid of the material identification completely. Only think about how can I please Krishna in this situation. So, not how can I please myself, and not even how can I please the other person. How can I please Krishna? Now, if you're trying to please Krishna, you'll do things that are good for you and good for the other person. But the mood is very different. So, you know, if you're trying to please your wife, you'll do all kinds of things to make her happy, and she won't always be happy. It just is what it is, what it is. And then you'll think, oh, I'm not a good husband, she doesn't love me. And the same thing, if you're always trying to please your husband, sometimes he'll be happy, sometimes he won't. It just is what it is, what it is. Sometimes the person will be unhappy for things that have nothing to do with you at all. And sometimes the person will actually be unhappy with you. And no matter how much they love you and how compatible you are and how much you want to be together, that just is. So if my sense of self-worth and my sense of self-identity and my sense of value and meaning and satisfaction is tied to other people appreciating me in terms of a material identity, I will be disappointed over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And I become very dependent on how other people deal with me, on how other people talk about me. Are you happy with what I did? Are you happy with what I did? Did I do a good job? Did I do a good job? Do you notice what I did? You know, we'll be constantly wanting to be noticed and appreciated and validated by other people. And other people will not do that all the time. They just will not. In fact, it's a rare thing that another human being really notices and appreciates and validates what we do. It's extremely unusual. No, it just doesn't happen very much. We're far more likely to get people noticing what we don't do or what we do wrong than noticing what we do and what we do right. And especially something we do all the time, you know. If you go to work every day, your wife tends to take it for granted that you're going to work every day. If you're taking care of the laundry all the time, the husband tends to take it for granted that you're taking care of the laundry all the time. I saw a really funny, heavy video that husband and wife are both working, and the wife says, you know, it's so hard for me working. I come home from work, and I still have to do all the laundry and all the cleaning and all the cooking, and it's too much. She was asking for appreciation and for help, right? So her husband says to her, it was a skit. It was a comedy skit. But it wasn't so funny. It was kind of like sort of funny, darkly funny. He says, you know, you don't need to stress about these things. He says, this is a magic house. He said, I just put my dirty clothes over there. And I come the next day and they're clean and dry and folded. He said, you should try it. Just put your clothes there. They'll come back clean and dry and folded. And he said, you see this table here? He said, no matter what mess you leave on this table at night, he said, in the morning it's clean. So when I wake up in the morning, it's always clean. He said, I've even tried to experiment by purposely putting a huge amount of mess on this table. And when I come in the morning, it's clean. So just don't stress about it. The house just takes care of itself. So she and in the skit, she goes out of the house and slams the door. So this is, you know, but it's typical that we don't really notice and appreciate things that people do all the time. It just becomes part of the background. Or we think that they have to do it. It's their job. Everybody's just doing their job. Why should I appreciate people for doing what they should do and what their job is? So we tend to be not so grateful and appreciative and noticing others. And other people tend not to be so grateful and appreciative in noticing us. So if that's our sustenance, that somebody is feeding my ego, that I'm a good husband, I'm a good wife, I'm a good father, I'm a good mother, I'm a good son, I'm a good daughter, I see this as creates pretty much all of the friction and discord and unhappiness between human beings. And if I'm just saying, hey, I want to be a good devotee, I want to make Krishna smile, well, then of course I'm going to take care of my husband or my wife or my son or my daughter or my mother or my father because Krishna wants it. And that is that I'm getting my appreciation from Krishna. And Krishna is very nice that he appreciates the intention and the effort. He's not that concerned about the result. And so if my intention is to please Krishna, and my effort is to keep peace happy, and I will feel satisfied. And I will feel appreciated whether or not other people appreciate me. And whether or not other people deal with me nicely. And what I found is if I think like that, if I do get upset with how other people deal with me, I can immediately understand the problem is not exactly how they dealt with me, the problem is in me, that I'm thinking that my sense of self-identity and my sense of self-worth is dependent on how other people appreciate me. Now, if somebody's actually abusive, that's another thing. If somebody's trying to kill you or something, you probably shouldn't hang around and just let them kill you. That's probably not a very good idea. But that's hopefully a rare exception that you won't have to deal with in your life. But anyway, those things, to bank on the spiritual, you know, to invest your happiness in your spirituality, not in your material situation. And to invest your happiness in your spiritual identity, not in a material one. And then I was talking about this a little bit also last night, is to see your service to the family as part of your spiritual service. Not to just think, well, just chanting Hare Krishna and, you know, worshiping the deity, that's spiritual, and school and job and family is all material. But to see that everything belongs to Krishna and everything's related to Krishna. And taking care of my husband, my wife, my children is all, can be, if I make it so, part of my offering. That everything I do can be part of my offering to Krishna, my brushing my teeth, whatever. How I deal with everybody. If I can be an agent of joy for others, that makes Krishna happy. He appreciates that. So that's always thinking in that way. You know, to see everything as spiritual. And those are the main things. I mean, other things I can think of is do try to get a career that's according to your nature, because Krishna says so. And I kind of believe in something that you're good at and that you enjoy and that you find fulfilling, and to do it in a way that helps the world. Don't just have a career to make money. And then there's lots and lots and lots and lots of good books and videos and courses about the dealings between men and women and the differences of psychologies between men and women. Those are all useful, but don't take them as absolute. No, they're useful. It's not that they're not useful. But just like my youngest son, I gave him one of these books to look at, and he said, you know, Mata, he said, actually, my wife and I don't fit the model on this one. Like, there's one model that when men are upset, they want to just go in a room and be by themselves and get over their upsetness by themselves and then come out when they're ready and you should leave them alone. Which I think for a lot of men is true. And that women, when they're upset, they want to talk to somebody. And I think for a lot of women that's true. But my son, my youngest son was saying, he said, you know what, Dad, when I'm upset, I like to talk to somebody, and when my wife's upset, she wants to be left alone. He said, so we don't fit that model. We're opposite in that regard. And I was thinking about it, I thought, yeah, it's true, actually, that I like that. And she's upset. She's like, I don't want to talk about it. I'll talk about it when I'm ready. I don't want to talk about it. But did I upset you? I don't want to talk about it. Just leave me alone until I'm ready to talk about it. I'll let you know. And she may never want to talk about it. She just kind of goes on with life. So she doesn't fit that particular model. So, you know, those books are useful. They have something to offer, and if you can find them useful, but they're not scripture. And we're all individuals. I do think that there's some fundamental things that are generally true for most men and generally true for most women. We are all individuals. There's a devotee friends of mine, very nice couple, Jayashrila and Vimala from New Zealand. And they have a Vrahastha course called, and a book called Five Drops Formula. They've written a book about how to diffuse conflict, which would be useful, I think, in any conflict between any human beings. But they've particularly written it for married couples, and I really highly recommend their book and their course. It's just excellently, excellently done. And then the Grahastha Vision team from North America also has a book about family and about parenting, and then they have courses in family life, which I really also highly recommend. I would recommend that before you get married that you do some compatibility study. So astrology is there, but I wouldn't take astrology as everything. I would also look at the family, look at the person. I'd ask people about the person. The main question I tell everybody to ask is the person mentally and emotionally stable? And someone said to me, well, does that mean that all unstable people can't get married? And I said, I don't know, but I found that most unstable people don't make very good marriage partners and don't tend to stay married. I remember with one person who was looking for a husband, and they were looking at someone, and we asked the question, and the answer was, well, he'll be stable once he gets married. I said, no, forget it. That's your number one question. Is this person mentally and emotionally stable? And then you want to look at what kind of personality they have, and that may take a little time for you to think about what you're interested in. I remember with my daughter, there was one young man that she met, and after a few months he decided he wasn't interested, and then there was another man she never actually met, and she was just corresponding, just actually talking to him on the phone like once a week. And then after a few months she decided she wasn't interested. And after that she said, you know, both of these guys were nice, Mata, but I've decided I really want a different type. She said, I think with either of these men, if I had married them, we could have been good friends, but I don't think there would have been a spark. She said, I really think I want someone else. So that took her a little bit of time to understand what she was looking for. And ask people. Or if you have someone else looking for you, which is ideal, have them ask people. Is this person like this? Is that like that? Think about what's most important. Don't have too long of a list about what's most important, because then you'll never find anybody. You know what I'm saying? If you've got 30 non-negotiables, you'll probably never get married. So keep it to like 3 to 5. Have like 3 to 5 non-negotiables, and then have preferences. And then think about what you bring. And a lot of people are like, what am I looking for in the other person? But they don't think about what they have to offer to the relationship. What do they bring into the relationship? Anyway, so I'd look really holistically. There's the program I'm certified in, which is PREPARE. I'm pretty sure it's that program, Prepare Enrich, that has an online compatibility that you can do. So it's designed, their compatibility study is designed to be done with a counselor who actually discusses it with you, but there's also an online thing. Now, that's only for people who already have been together. So that's not something you can do if you haven't already had anything to do with the person. But if you've already met someone and you've spent some time communicating with them and some time together, I would really suggest you taking one of those things before you actually make a commitment, because they show you what the strengths and the challenges will be in the relationship. And I feel it's always better, if you can, to have some idea of what your strengths and challenges are going to be before you get married. So first of all, you can decide, well, do I want to deal with this? Because every relationship has some challenges, and you can say, is this the challenge I want to deal with? Or not. And another thing is, some things you can try to work out before you get married, rather than just trying to work them out afterwards. You know, you don't want a situation where after you get married, one person says, well, I want 12 children, and the other one says, I don't want any. Which happens, but, you know, something like that. So to look at those kind of things. I think that's it. What would you like to add to this discussion before we open it to for questions?
Well, I'll try to be brief. I guess I'm not really much older than any of you. So I have experience for a decent amount, but there's still a lot from myself to learn. But I think I can give a little advice and a few things I've noticed, I suppose. I guess first off, when you're young, it's not always clear what you want to do. And even now, I think that even though I already have a degree and I'm already married, that my ultimate goals in life aren't set. They're not clear, and that's okay. It's okay to not know exactly what you want to do, because chances are you're not going to find something perfect anyway. Your perfect, ideal life is probably not going to happen. It's like winning a lottery. And you have to find it in yourself to be satisfied with what you get related to how much work you put into trying to get what you want. Like for myself, I'm a little bit lazy. But I do like working, and I like earning money. So I spent 2 years in school trying to figure out what I liked, and I figured that I could get a good living without having to work super hard by studying computer science. And so I studied computer science, and now I have a degree, which I can use to earn a decent living. And so I wasn't willing to put in a certain amount of work to become, say, a professional tennis player, which is what I wanted to be when I was a kid, because that required a lot of work and a lot of dedication. And sure, if I maybe put in all the hours and days and weeks and months and years of work when I was a kid, who knows where I'd be right now when it comes to that. Maybe I'd be successful, maybe I wouldn't be. I would have put in a lot of work. Maybe I wouldn't have been satisfied, maybe I would have. But the point is that being attached to the result will often lead to disappointment. And so, obviously, if you just see your studying and you see your relationship as a service to Krishna, then the result won't matter anyway. So that's like the easy way to not be attached to the result, right? Then the process, that would be the satisfying part. But you can also do it mechanically, and sometimes you do have to do it mechanically. You just have to say, well, you know, I'm going to be satisfied with what I get, and that's what it's going to be. And then when it happens, you are. If you do it properly, and you still don't like let that attachment get to you. So, yeah, that's not hard to do if you take it incrementally. So if I had just said, you know, I want to be a professional tennis player, and that's my goal, and if I don't get that goal, then I will be dissatisfied, otherwise I'll be satisfied. Right, then it's like too clear cut, and I'm probably going to end up being dissatisfied, right? So at a certain point I realized that wasn't a realistic goal, so I was like, well, maybe I'll become a pilot. Right, because that's a little more reachable, because there's a lot more successful pilots than tennis players. But that requires a lot of work, right? So then I took the next step down, and I was like, well, maybe I'll become a 3D artist, right? Designing video games or models on the computer, right? Takes even less effort, because you can teach yourself that, and you can make a good living, but you could also not make a good living. And so that didn't work out, because it does also require a lot of work, and you see what I'm saying? So just allowing yourself to be flexible in what you want, and not being attached to just one result, is going to save you a lot of distress. Also, throughout your life, you're going to meet a lot of people, and almost all of those people will have some sort of opinion on how you ought to live your life based on their past. And oftentimes they can give you good advice. You know, more experienced people have gone through something that they don't want you to go through, and so they'll tell you how to avoid it. And that can be useful. However, it's also a little it's a little dangerous to take advice without a grain of salt, especially if you, regardless, even if you know the person or you don't. If you know the person really well, then you'll know probably why they're giving you the advice, and if you don't know the person very well, then they could be giving you that advice for any sort of reason you have no idea. Your life is your life, to use how you wish, and someone's advice, whether it be marriage or career, should not shape you. Because I kind of did a lot of things at a young age. I got married young and I finished school young. I guess they don't, envious isn't really the right word. There are, of course, some envious people who are like, oh, this guy got his life together and at a young age, and he's, maybe I wish I could have done that, or he's just born lucky. You know, I have a good grandmother as well, and a good family, a loving, supporting family. So I am lucky. And so their advice will be tainted with that, right? And then there are some who are just well-wishing, and they have their experience, and they tell you these things, and you're like, oh yeah, you know, that ought to help me in my marriage whenever it comes up, or it's like, oh, maybe I just should consider this different idea when choosing my career. But in the end, if you don't see, if you remain attached to what you want, to the extent that you would be disappointed if you don't get that otherwise, and you don't see your life as some sort of, as service, if you don't, if you see that everyone else is there to serve you and you're not there to serve others, you'll make bad decisions. So my advice to all of you would be that to accept advice gratefully, because it's a lot better than people hating on you directly or wishing you ill. And even if the advice is given in some sort of context of envy, or there's some ill motive behind it, that's not to say there's nothing you can take out of it. So hear out advice. Don't refuse it. Friends are very valuable. And don't let it shape you. Just understand that everyone has their own experiences. You have your own life that will be different from their life. And you have the ultimate say in what you do. People don't own you. People don't control you. And I guess the the last thing would be don't take the idea of your life as service too far. In other words, if you find yourself being unhappy, trying to do too much service, like putting yourself too low or sacrificing your own happiness too often for the sake of other people's happiness, and again, being attached to that result, that can result in all sorts of problems. Then that's not really ideal, is it? It's not ideal to be in a situation where you feel like, oh, I'm sacrificing so much, and what am I getting out of it? Your own happiness is important to your accomplishments and what you can do for Krishna. If you don't enjoy your service, then how can you do good? That's not, Krishna's not pleased with that. So at a certain point, you may have to ask yourself, is what I'm doing good for me? Because your own happiness is one of the most important things. So don't forget that, because it's certain to come up. And I hope that if and when it does, that you'll not take your own happiness and put it as a low priority. That's just a few things. Hope that helps.
So anybody have anything you want to bring up?
No, sure, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
They were telling me that I should have a program for the children at 8 o'clock.
Yeah, he sleeps at 8:30.
And this is what I told them. I said, you cannot have a program for children at 8 o'clock at night.
If it's tomorrow, 8 o'clock?
No.
It's school day, yeah, tomorrow 8 o'clock. It's school day.
No,
it's not going to be 8. They made it a different time.
Ah, like 6 to 7.
But I told them, 8 o'clock, this is what happens.
8 o'clock.
Anyway, just a little observation. They tell me, oh, the children will come at 8 o'clock. I'm like, I don't even want the children to come.
And open Q&A.
What?
And open Q&A.
Yeah, they wanted an open Q&A from age 4 to 14. At 8 o'clock at night?
It's 6:30 to 7:30.
6:30 to 7:30. Okay, that's at least possible. So yes, what did you want to
ask? Is there an ideal age that one should actually look to get married? Like, is there like right age?
Well, I like what Jayadeva just said, that you can't put someone else's life on your life. And you know, we can talk in generalities, but I don't think generalities necessarily apply to individuals. So that you'll have to. I thought that was a very wise thing.
Yeah,
to say.
I heard that. That's why this question came up, because I was reading some other articles, not Krishna consciousness articles, but they talked about how girls actually should actually try to get married as early as possible, because the way the God has created the entire.
Well, that's true biologically.
Biologically.
There was a book I read recently, and written by a doctor, and one of the comments was, if your ideology doesn't match biology, there's something wrong with your ideology. And I see that biology is one way that God communicates to us what is true and what is His will. But we don't have a society now that is in tune with biology. Our modern society is not in tune with biology on almost any level. In terms of what we eat, in terms of our schedule. And often the people who are most out of sync with biology are doctors. Seriously.
Sure.
To become a doctor, you have to work 80 to like 100 hours a week as an intern, as a resident. They often sleep all kinds of odd hours and don't get a chance to eat healthy food. So it's one of these ironies that modern medicine... The people in modern medicine are often the most out of sync with their own biology. But we don't have a society that's in harmony with biology, in general, across the board, whatever we're talking about. We're not really working in ways that are in harmony with the environment of the planet and with the environment of our own bodies. So, biologically speaking, probably everybody should be married by the time they're 20, 25. Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavatam that 16 should be maximum for girls and 24 maximum for boys. And if you think about, Gandhi married when he was 13, Bhaktivinoda married when he was 14, Lord Chaitanya married at 14. So, basically until World War II, so like up through the 1930s, pretty much all over the world, most people were married by the time they were 20. And a lot of people were married by 15, 16. That was pretty much the standard all over the world for all cultures. But the society in general was very different. So first of all, you had more support from your family. If, you know, if it was still more of the extended family and support from your family. Second of all, most people didn't need so much education just to have a living. So the vast majority of people could have a decent living and maintain a family with a level of education that we would right now consider quite low. I mean, Prabhupada himself married at 22, and he married a girl who was 11. So his wife was 11, he was 22. And Prabhupada was in his third year of university, so he wasn't, he hadn't even graduated. And he made the point, he said, you know, they weren't worried, the families weren't worried, because they figured he's in university, he'll get a degree, and he'll be able to support a family. And Prabhupada was shocked when he went to America and asked a woman whose son was in her 20s, why isn't he married? And she said, well, I don't know if he can maintain a family. And Prabhupada was just shocked. He thought, I guess it's really difficult to maintain a family in the West. So, you know, yeah, I mean, biologically, women's risk of all sorts of cancers go down if her first baby's born before she's 20, for example. But that's, for most people, that's not very practical. It's just is what it is, what it is, what it is. We see that most people who wait till they're 30 or 35 to get married, how do I put this politely? They're not celibate, let's just say. Most people are not able to really go without some sort of emotional and physical sexual satisfaction until they're 30 or 35 years old. And that's kind of the age that marriage is being pushed to. I read an article that even married women who have their first baby before 30, that people will say, oh, aren't you too young to have a child? Anyway, this is the problem, that in modern society, you know, have a boyfriend or girlfriend and have illicit sex, that's fine. You know, but don't get married. So this is more and more happening. Probably not so much here, but in India even. It's like that. It is. You know, and even among educated Indian families, they'll say, don't even think about this until you have your degree. Or your master's degree, and they'll push for the girls too. You have to have a master's, you have to have a PhD before you can think about getting married. And then you meet all these women who have all these degrees and don't even use them, which I just think is just so funny. Married woman, and oh yeah, I have a degree in engineering. What do you do with it? Nothing. Why did you get it? You know, but it somehow it's considered the girl's not marriageable without at least a master's degree. And it's like, why? Strange way of thinking. So it's a difficult thing to say. I mean, Prabhupada said that he didn't have any objection to boys and girls studying in college together as long as people were married. So, for the vast majority of people, psychologically and biologically, marriage should take place sometime between late teens and early 20s. Mid-late teens, early 20s, for most people, psychologically and biologically. But socially and societally, that may not be a very practical option for a lot of people, but that leaves people with all these very, very strong unmet needs. You know, it's putting human beings at the time of their life when they have the most energy in a situation where they have some very, very strong psychological and physiological unmet needs, which is dangerous and stupid, in my opinion. You know, and the main source of criminality in the world is single young men. They're the main criminals and troublemakers in society. And then there's so much research that, you know, what mostly civilizes men is marriage. Not girlfriends, but marriage. But we could solve a lot of the problems in the world just by having people get married. Yeah. I mean, I was recently in Spain in Madrid, where there's a really big nightclub culture in Madrid. And Spain is kind of weird, where, like in most parts of Europe, the nightclubbing culture, people are going to bed by 3 or 4 in the morning. Like when you get up from Mallorca and Iscon Soho, it's just like the last, isn't it? The last ones, you know? The last drunks and the last prostitutes and go-go dancers or whatever are going home. It starts to get kind of quiet at 4. Right when you want to wake up is when it gets quiet, isn't it? But in Madrid, they're going on until 6:30 or 7 in the morning. They're still partying. I mean, part of that is because Spain is on a weird time zone. And so the time zone doesn't match the sun, that's part of it. But anyway, so we'd go out, you know, after Mangalarti, we're going out for a Joppa walk early in the morning. And there's still all these young people who are all drunk, and probably a lot of them are on drugs also. You know, not behaving properly sexually in public. And you know very well that if they were married with a kid, they wouldn't be there. They just wouldn't be there. It wouldn't be happening. If all those people were married and having children and having a career and having a home, they would not be doing that. So it's, you know, you'd eliminate a huge amount of problems in society in general and for individuals. And then what I see happening is people wait. You know, they don't even start thinking about marriage till they're like 25, 26 years old. And then it may take a few years to find somebody that they even want to consider marrying, so it may take 2 or 3 years to find somebody. By that time, they're 27, 28, and then they want to get to know them for a while, and they're not getting married until they're 30 or 31. And then they think, well, I don't know if we want to have children right away. And then when they're like 33, 34, they think about having children. And by that time, their fertility's down and they can't have children. And I get people crying to me all the time, you know, I can't have children. When did you get married? Oh, when I was 34. You know, so it's just, or people say, well, I really wanted 5 children, but I only could have 2 because we didn't even get started until we were 36. So I run into that all. And then the other thing about marrying really late is that you're already kind of set in your ways, how you want to live. Maybe you already have your own house. It's hard to deal with somebody else and work your life around somebody else. But having said that, there are some people who are really happy that they married late. So, you know, I really like what Jai Roy just said. It's not. Like my god-sister Vishaka and her husband Yadubar, they spent their youth traveling around the world with Srila Prabhupada taking photographs. So they got married. Prabhupada got them married. He pushed for them to get married. They came to India as boyfriend and girlfriend, and he pushed for them to get married. But they spent all their youthful life, as I said, traveling around the world with Prabhupada, taking pictures, making films. That's what they did. They didn't really have a normal married life for the first 10 years. And they had their children very late. So they're older than I am, and one of their daughters is only maybe 21, 22 years old, not yet married. An older one is maybe 26 or something. You know, but for them, that worked for them. I mean, they were both fairly young when they got married, but they didn't have what I would call really like a much of a married life at first. And that was something that worked for them and their life and their and what was going on for them. And so to just put a, you know, for me, I'm very happy I got married young. I had my children young. And so by the time my children were grown up, my husband and I could renounce, and I was still young. And I, you know, still have youthful energy to be there to help with my grandchildren and, you know, to help my children in their own life and help them with their own children and to get to see my grandchildren grow up, and maybe I already have a great-grandson. So I see that as that I still have energy and ability to then become a full-time preacher in the movement, and I've done all that. You know, so if my mind says, do you want to do that? I say, well, I already did it. You follow? Well, my mind doesn't even ask the question anymore. Can I try? Oh, yeah, I already did that. Oh, yeah, okay. But I know other people who've seen the opposite, where they wanted to use their youthful life to have their career and travel all over the world and do this and do that and the other thing, and then they want to settle down when they're older. So it's... But traditionally, scripturally, it's... Generally, it's recommended it's something that's done when you're young. Throughout the history of mankind, it's generally something that's done when people are young. Very long answer.
That's good too. Do you have any follow-up questions? Because I have one on what Jed said.
Why don't you ask him?
Yeah. And you said about happiness, and you said that, you know, one should look at actually, you know, you should actually go and see if you're not happy with something, then you need to see it in service or anything like that. For example, you know, things you're doing which you're not happy about, you're doing it as a responsibility or as a duty, and you continue to suffer in that, but you continue to do that for a long period of time, and you know, and then actually you start hating it what you're doing, but you still continue, and then there are situations which you are trying to change, but you can't because you know things around you or responsibility you should take around you is not possible. In that situation, you know, if anybody actually decides that my happiness is more than my responsibilities or my duties, then the entire society look at me as a selfish individual who has actually, just for his own happiness, sacrificed and not done their duties or responsibilities properly. So in that scenario, how should actually, like for example, I'm not talking from the girls' or the boys' point of view, but the many decisions they take because or many things are actually forced upon them, and they think they have a duty towards their parents to actually just oblige and to do it, rather than actually go and protest, as I said before. And they continue to do that actually for some time. And they are not able to actually, you know, come out of it. And if they do it, the entire society looks down upon them. Mm-hmm. Especially in Indian culture, it is very strong, especially with the girls, how they have to behave at home, in terms of their marriage, whom they should get married and all that. A lot of decisions are actually driven from top down rather than bottom up. So, you know, they will be put into that situation. And then when they do it, actually think that my happiness is more important than my parents' happiness, everybody looks down upon that. So what kind of advice you can actually give? Because of the Indian culture, it's a little different than what culture you have come from. And I really like, you know, great to know that, you know, that what you have done, I'm really happy about it. But it's a little different for these. So.
Sure. I can try to give it my own opinion, I guess. Well, first off, I don't think you're ever forced to do anything. You always have a choice. Even if it seems like there's only one good option, you know, in your case, like say your parents want you to do something, and you're like, well, I have to do it because otherwise I'll be unhappy, and so you just do it. Like, you still do have a choice, many choices. Often you have times you have many, many things that you can do, and you just don't open yourself to those other options because perhaps you don't want to think about the consequences, or it's just too difficult. Like, it's easy to go down the path that's presented to you, so you just do that. So you always have to consider that. I mean, not following your parents and pursuing your own dreams and happiness is totally a choice. Or what else could you do? You could try to compromise and see if you could try to find a balance between your parents' happiness and your own happiness. You know, this, you know, there being only one option, that being obligation. It's not the only option, so don't forget that. Especially when times will happen where you'll see, like, I have no other option. This is the only option, and I will do it because it's the only option. It's not true. Secondly, it is a tough situation in which you feel like, well, if I don't do this certain thing that I know I won't like, then others, maybe people I care about a lot, will be very disappointed with me, they'll be angry at me, they won't want to be with me, and then people will look down upon me. If I do what I want, then... I mean, if I don't do what I want, but I do what they want, then the only person who's unhappy is myself, right? And in a situation like that, you do have to ask yourself, what is going to make myself a better person? So it's impossible to know what's going to happen, right? However, we do know that what we maybe perhaps want in the moment, or perhaps want for ourselves in the future, is not actually what we need. And we won't know that until we choose to do that, and when it happens, we may realize that we made a mistake. So, knowing that, how can one be confident in making a decision? And I mean, in my personal opinion, I'd say that there isn't really a way to know how to make a perfect decision. The best that you can do is seek the advice of others, seek the advice of peers, and of those who are lower than you and those who are higher than you, and then make an informed decision that best helps you to anticipate what will happen in the future. So, for example, if you wanted to, if you're in a situation where your parents are like, you do this, and this will make us happy, and you don't want to do it, then you first consider all your options, right? Because there will never be just one option. And then you can go to others, your friends, your family, your parents even, you know, and perhaps your siblings who are younger than you, and see, like, because you don't know everything. You can't anticipate your future, even though you probably know yourself as well as anybody could know yourself. There will be things that you don't realize, and things that you may not have thought of. So, I don't think there's... I mean, you could say, well, I don't have any friends, and my family doesn't love me, and there's nobody I can talk to. That is not true. I don't think there's anybody, unless you live, like, in a forest by yourself, in which case, this doesn't apply to you anyway. And if for some reason you don't have access to those who you can speak to, you can pray to Krishna, because Krishna is everywhere. And although he may not give you a direct answer, oftentimes you may still feel inclined toward a certain decision. And you feel like, well, even if this decision may not be the best decision, it's the decision I'm making. And again, going back to what I said before, that if you see your life as service to Krishna, you have to say, okay, I'm doing this as I'm making this decision as a service to you, and so please try to help me to fulfill this desire of mine, whether it be to please your parents or to pursue something that you know will make you happy. And then you just have to do it. Sometimes there isn't a decision that makes everyone happy, and there's just nothing you can do about that. You have to make a decision. You have to realize that there's many things that you can do. Pray about it, and make a decision. Make a decision not being attached to the result, but understanding that Krishna will always take care of you. And sure, maybe people look down upon you, maybe they won't. You can't actually know that. So that's what I would, in an ideal world, what I would do. But probably the most important thing is to realize that those things, that you always have decisions, more than one, that you should consider the opinions and advice of others, friends, and in the end, it's just pray to Krishna and accept that whatever happens, whatever result you get, one that you can't anticipate, that's the one that you made as a sacrifice for Krishna.
I really like what you said about that we always have a choice. One of the most damaging things you can do to yourself is to use words like have to and should and have a choice, because it's never true. It's just absolutely never true. Even if you only have one course of behavior open to you, you have many different choices in your mentality and your consciousness. So it's very rare that there's only one behavioral option, first of all. You know, and to really look at things and say, whatever you do, it should be because you're choosing to do it, because you are choosing to do it. So it's a question of admitting that. If you choose to put aside something that you would have done in order to make somebody else happy, then you're choosing to do that. And then you say, okay, why am I choosing to do this? Like, I was speaking to a devotee woman whose mother was visiting. Her mother wasn't a devotee. Her mother was from another country and wanted to go sightseeing. And the daughter was saying, the grown daughter was saying, I don't want to go to these places. I'm just going because my mother wants to go. And I said, well, there must be something you want for which you're going. He said, what is it you do want? Do you want to make your mother happy? She says, yeah. I said, do you want to spend time with your mother? She said, yeah. I said, then you are choosing to go for those reasons. You're not choosing to go because you want to see the mountain, because you don't care about the mountain, but you are choosing to go because of that. And it changes everything. And a lot of people are terrified of asking themselves what they want, because they're afraid if they look at what they want, they'll do something irresponsible. But if you really, really, really do not want to do it, then for goodness sakes, don't do it. Krishna does not want us to force ourselves against our will to do something that we're going to be internally fighting against and resisting. That is not the Lord's will. It just isn't. It wouldn't be our will for anyone that we loved. It's not what he wants. He wants us to do things out of a willful, joyful decision to do it. And if there's something... I mean, at one point my husband asked me to do something, and I couldn't do it. Just couldn't do it. When he went to the hotel president, he complained, and he said, you know, asking my wife to do something, she just won't do it. And he said, well, your request is reasonable, but don't force people. Leave her alone. And then he talked to me, the hotel president talked to me, and said, your husband's asking you something reasonable. He's not asking you anything that's wrong or unreasonable. So if you just, you know, out and out refuse, that's not really a very good thing. So why don't you think about this and plan for it, and when you're ready, let him know. And he told my husband, leave her alone. She'll tell you when she's ready. And that's what happened. It was about a year and a half later. I said, okay, I'm ready. And it would really have damaged me to say I was ready when I wasn't ready. And it would have really damaged him to have forced me. It would have damaged our relationship. So there are some times when you have to say, look, I respect you and I love you and I care about you, but I can't do this right now. I just can't. Maybe I can do it later, but I can't do it right now. I just can't. I'm sorry. And if I try to force myself to do it, I'm going to damage myself. So, you know, my father, when I was growing up, always taught me, don't force things, you'll break them. I mean, he was talking about like mechanical things, but it's true spiritually also. If we're trying to force ourselves, we can become physically sick, we can become, you know, mentally depressed. Like you're saying, going on and on and on for years and hating it. Do we really believe that God wants that from any? What kind of a God would that be? He doesn't want it. So the best thing is, if you're going to do something because you think you should, then recognize that you're choosing it, recognize why you're choosing it, and delight in the choice. And do it as an offering for Krishna, and take delight in that. And if you absolutely cannot do that, then you really do need to do what Jayaraja said. You need to negotiate. And this concept that I have only one choice is just, it isn't the case. Even if someone has a gun to your head, you can choose to let them shoot you. You know what I'm saying? You are making a choice. Whenever we say to ourselves, I have no choice, I must do this. Someone said this to me the other day. My husband said he didn't have an affair with that woman. He just talked to her on the phone a few times, and yeah, it went too far, but he never actually did anything. I guess I have to trust him. I said, no, you don't have to trust him. He said, you can choose to trust him or not. Do you choose to trust him? She said, yeah, I do. I said, okay, then that's your choice. You're choosing that. You don't have to. So anytime we find ourselves using these words, I should, I have to, I must, we're lying to ourselves. It's just, it's not the case. It isn't the case. It's a very important thing. And I do know that, you know, there are cultural differences, there are cultures that much more push that you have to be concerned about your community, and others are, you have to be concerned more about individuality. But both are true. They're both always true. Yes, we should be concerned with what we're doing as to how it will affect other people in our lives and other living entities and the society. And we also have to be concerned about ourselves. Because we're not going to be of any use to anybody if we're broken. You know, I mean, that's, even if all you care about is your family and your society, you still have to take care of yourself. Isn't it? So, and if you're miserable and trying to force yourself to do something and hating it, don't you think that's going to be obvious to other people on some level? Isn't that going to come out? How much can you repress that? If you are successful with repressing it, you'll probably have serious lifelong diseases. Seriously, really? It's a fact. A lot of ongoing serious diseases comes from repression. And you can't repress it all the time anyway. It'll come out sometimes that you're resentful and you're angry and you're disappointed and you're frustrated. I'm serving you all the time, but I don't like it. I'm doing it because it's my duty. And who wants to be served like that anyway? I'm doing stuff for you, but I don't like it. I'd rather be doing something else. And go do something else, please. And who wants to be served like that? So it's, well, I don't know. How is that attractive? I mean, all of us have to do some things in life that we don't like and that we wish we didn't have to do. I mean, duh. You know, I wish my hair would wash itself once a week. I don't like washing my hair. What am I going to do? Yeah. Okay, I could shave it off. Well, my husband wouldn't like that. And then I'd have to shave it. Instead of washing it, I'd have to shave it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, what do you do? There's things in life you don't like to do, and you just have to do it. I love being a mother, but I didn't really like cleaning up vomit in my bed at 2 o'clock in the morning. Because the kid's too young to know that they have to throw up in the toilet. You know, it happens. I don't like it. I wish I had a servant I could call, hey, clean up the vomit in my bed at 2 o'clock. You know. Some things you just go, okay. That's just life. Everybody has things, even if you're doing a job you love, and even if you're married to someone you love, and wonderful children, everything's wonderful in your life, you still have to do some things that you don't like. Just welcome to the world. Then all you can do is say, Krishna, I'm doing this for you. I really wish that my kid had not thrown up in my bed at 2 o'clock in the morning. I hope you're happy with me for cleaning it up. That's all. Yeah. That's all you can do for that kind of stuff. But if that's 24/7, there's something really wrong, you know? If that's your life. If all day long you're like, I hate my life, I hate my life, I hate what I'm doing, I don't want to be doing what I'm doing, I just have to, I'm just socially obligated, other people expecting it of me. Who wants to live like that? And what kind of God wants you to live like that? Why would you want to serve a God who wanted you to live like that? Yes, Krishna, I want to love you, I want to serve you because you're making me a miserable slave my whole life. Really? And everyone else should become Krishna conscious and be miserable like me. It's not true. We're getting late. Is there anybody else who wanted to ask anything? Anything? No? Are you all just very shy?
We all are clear.
Huh?
We all are clear.
You're all clear or are you all just shy?
Ask questions.
Anything at all? Don't worry, he already said you can take my answer with a grain of salt.
If they're all set.
Guess we're all set?
Yeah.
All right.
One question last on behalf of them. Did they ask me?
Okay.
So, in terms of compatibility, you said about horoscope compatibility and that. But one of the most important things is about they having a spiritual compatibility. So, how do you determine, especially in an arranged marriage where a boy comes, you know, you get a resume, a horoscope, and then you talk probably on the phone or chat or something like that. How do we determine, how does a girl or a boy determine the spiritual compatibility of that person so that you are actually, you know, because that's, the people I speak to right now, the biggest problem they are facing is the spiritual compatibility between husband and wife.
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually creating a lot of problems within their marriage lifetime.
First of all, I think it's very difficult to be 100% spiritually compatible with somebody else. Some people are very fortunate. In general, you know, you've got, like Jai Dorje said about winning the lottery. You know, some people win the marriage lottery. But in general, you're going to get some areas of compatibility and some areas of not. By the way, if you're really compatible with somebody, it will mean you share the same problems also. So, keep that in mind. And even spiritually, sometimes having somebody who's somewhat different from you spiritually helps you to grow and be more broad-minded. All areas of incompatibility don't mean there's necessarily something bad. You know, we are different. You never find two people exactly the same. And anyway, that would be boring. And we can, it's a question of what you do with the differences, not so much that you don't have them. You know, can we see that somebody has strengths in an area that I have weakness? So somebody may be spiritually strong in an area that I'm weak. Maybe I don't even know that. Until I'm with that person. So that's also true. And the other thing is that people change. So even if you feel totally compatible when you get married, 5-10 years from down the road, people may change. It's something else as well. So, but how do you do the best job as possible in the beginning? I mean, I really feel that there should be some standard questionnaires, like for the prepare thing. They have standard questions that really help determine compatibility, and some of them deal with religion and spirituality. There's a survey that I've used from the Canadian government of British Columbia that's some really good questions for people to go through before they get married. I really like that one. And you might want to, for your community, compare some lists that people talk to each other, because they may not think of asking those questions. And again, if there's something that's really, really important to you, for goodness sake, insist on it and ask that question. You don't have arranged marriages in that you don't see each other until before the wedding day, yeah? It's more like an arranged introduction, yes? You can say no, correct? The people can say no, correct?
Yeah.
A literally arranged marriage is you have no say in it at all and you meet the person for the first time at the wedding. But I don't think you're doing that, right? Right? It's more an arranged introduction, is what I would call it. And however much time and facility they're giving you to make a decision, you have the right to say no. Yes? Correct. Okay. So figure out what are your priorities and what are your spiritual priorities. Again, don't make too many or you don't find anybody. But you can't have 100. I mean, you can, but you won't get married. You know, and remember that you're not perfect either. That's a hard question. You know, you have your faults and you have your whatever, your struggles. But have some priority and ask. Don't be shy, ask. Better to ask before you get married and than to get married and get a shock. No, this is not an area where you want to be shy about it. If there's something that's really important to you, ask. And I would really take the guidance of seniors as to what to ask. You know, like I said, always ask, don't ask the person, ask other people. Is this person mentally and emotionally stable? That you should ask. Ask their friends and ask their friends to suggest other friends. Go a couple circles out and ask that question. Make sure you ask that question. You know, you don't want to marry someone who has like serious rage issues. You understand what I'm saying? Or serious ego issues where they can never be told they're wrong about anything. I mean, you just don't want to deal with something. And if you're like that, get some help before you inflict yourself on somebody else. But yeah, what's most important to you spiritually? Figure it out. And that's not going to be the same for everybody, you know. It just isn't. So I can't tell you what are the most important things for you. You've got to decide that. Does that make sense? Yeah, ask. And another thing to ask is, you know, when my daughter's daughter got married, it was pretty close to an arranged marriage. I mean, I don't think they met each other until after they had actually decided to get married. I'm like, I don't think so. I think they met each other physically 2 or 3 days before they had a big engagement party, and then they had their wedding 3 days after that. So they just had some communication over the phone, which is what they both wanted. And she said to him, look, you know, I'm like this, I'm like that, I've done this, I've done that. But do you still want to marry me? And he said, yes. So she also said that. You know, this is my nature, this is my personality, this is what I do, this is how I live. Are you okay with that? So she didn't just say, hey, what do you do? This is what I do. That's what I'm saying. Don't just think about the other, think about yourself. Is that reasonable? And mostly you want compatibility of ideals more than, you know, really specific practices, because that might change over time. You know, do you share the same ideals? So I think it would be extremely hard to marry someone who doesn't believe in God. You know, that would be very difficult. One of the saddest stories that I ever heard was I'd gone to a Sanskrit immersion camp, and this was from the days of actual arranged marriages. It wasn't an arranged introduction. But the woman who was teaching had a PhD in Sanskrit, and she said that as far as she knew, she was the first person in her university in India, who was a woman who got a PhD in Sanskrit. And she was very religious. She said that she was, especially Ram Bhakta, but she was always worshipping Ram, and she had memorized huge parts of the Ramayana in Sanskrit, and she was always singing to Ram and, you know, chanting japa for hours. But her parents considered, so you can tell this is an old story, her parents considered that her having a PhD made her basically unmarriageable. Now it's kind of reversed, isn't it? You know, they're telling you have to have a bachelor's or a master's to be marriageable, but in those days they told her having a PhD made her unmarriageable. So they knew a family whose son had gone to America and had gotten a PhD in something. And so they figured, they knew the family was good. So they knew the family's been good. They didn't really know the boy. And they just figured, you have a PhD, he has a PhD, it'll work. Well, the boy was an atheist. Well, he was an atheist, he was a meat eater, and, you know, he flew to India and married her, you know, without them talking at all, and then right after the marriage, she immediately flew to America and lived with him. And he forbade her to do any kind of worship in the house at all. She was just not allowed to do any, you know, she wasn't allowed to have deity, she wasn't allowed to chant japa, she wasn't allowed to have a vegetarian house, or to raise the kids as vegetarian. He was really heavy with her. And she said that it was only when she got to be in her 40s that she opened her own Sanskrit school, and in the context of her Sanskrit school, she was able to be open with her devotion, because in her Sanskrit school, naturally, a lot of what's in Sanskrit is Shastra. So she was able to study the Shastra and teach it in her Sanskrit school. You know, but her parents never asked that question. They never asked, because the man's parents were devoted people, but he wasn't. And they never asked the question. They didn't look at their daughter's devotion as something important. And they didn't ask those parents the question, is your son devoted? They didn't ask him. So ask. Don't assume. In America we say, assume, you know, A-S-S-U-M-E. We say, assume makes an ass of you and me. So don't assume that just because somebody's parents are Krishna conscious that necessarily they are. Or that just because they look like they're Krishna conscious. I mean, I know one devotee girl got involved with who someone she thought was a devotee boy, and he said, I don't tell my parents, but I'm actually an atheist. So, you know, anyway, she got a little too far into the relationship, unfortunately. She got out of it, but she got too far into it, and she got hurt. Ask. Pick what's important to you and ask. And be honest about who you are. Don't pretend to be a better or different devotee than you are, also. That's very cool, either. Does that make sense to everybody? And pray to Krishna, too. You know, he's part of the picture. One of my very good friends, she didn't want to get married at all. She was born in Mayapur in Bengal to devotees. Initiated devotees. She just did not want to get married. But everyone said, no, you know, you need to get married. So she went to the deities and she had three requests about who she wanted to marry. What kind of person she wanted to marry. All right, if you want me to get married, fine, but I have these requests. And she got all three of them. She also, and one of her requests was she wanted a completely arranged marriage. She did not want an arranged introduction. She just wanted an arranged marriage. That was one of the things she wanted. She wanted an arranged marriage that where her guru and the guru of the other person was involved in the arrangement. But she did not want another person before the wedding. That's what she got. It was interesting. Anyway, she got everything. One of them she didn't find out until after she got married. Which I thought was interesting. So you can also talk to Krishna. Tell him what you want. Another one of my very good friends who married quite late. She married like at 36. And it was the kind of person that you couldn't understand why she wasn't married. Physically, she was very beautiful. Just like, oh my God, she was so beautiful. And psychologically, just such a lovely, lovely person. I'm just an absolutely lovely person, very feminine. And you're just like, how come it's just not working out for her that she's not getting married? So she was driving me to the airport and talking to me about it. And I said, you know, do you know what you're looking for? She said, not really. I said, why don't you really meditate on it and pray about it? Write it down. Give it to Krishna. And a year later, she married exactly what she was looking for. Have some idea. Be honest. Don't have too many requirements. A few non-negotiables, the rest preferences. Be honest about what you're going to bring to a relationship, what you want, what you're going to be. Understand? If you hate cooking, don't pretend that you're going to make gourmet meals three times a day.
You understand?
Yeah. Be honest yourself. All right? Okay, Hare Krishna.
Thank you.